Now, there's something else here. It's the Greek myth of Echo and Narcissus. This is all about the echoing of the sound. Echo was a nymph who Jove had go talk to Juno at length and talk endlessly to Juno so he could run around and seduce earthly women. Well, Juno found out about it. Now, Echo was just doing what she was commanded to do. Juno found out about it and punished Echo, who had been the talker, her conversationalist, by saying, "You may no longer talk, you may only repeat the last thing you hear somebody else say." Hence we get our word echo. That's where the word comes from, okay? Echo is also punished then by falling in love with a mortal. He was a beautiful young man named Narcissus. Narcissus rejected her love. Why? Because he had a deeper and more profound love. He looked in the brook and saw his own image and fell in love with it. Like many of the characters in this play, self-love, self-love, self-love. And Narcissus was so in love with this beautiful figure in the brook, having rejected Echo, that he tried to embrace it, fell in, and drowned, was overwhelmed by the water. And Echo withered away. It's clear he's using this here, okay? It's clear that devotion of love, where all one can do is echo the name of the beloved, being rejected by the beloved, but just being patient and enduring it and withering away. How do we know Shakespeare had this in mind? Because I'm going to take you to another great passage of poetry. This is on page 112. Viola's gone back to report to Orsino and saying, "No, you know, she rejects your love. What can I do?" And he is saying, "Oh, poor me, poor me." And he says, "My love is greater." And Viola's basically saying, "Well, you know, women love as much." No, he says, "No woman loves as much as I love. Men love more than women can possibly do." And he goes on, "There is no woman's sides can bide the beating of so strong a passion as love doth give my heart." Boy, Narcissus, Narcissus, it's me, me. Boy, me. I'm important. He goes on at length, "Mine is as hungry as the sea and can digest as much. Aye, but I know, what dost thou know? Too well what love women to men may owe. In faith they are as true of heart as we. My father had a daughter, loved a man." Well, we know who she's talking about. Yes, her father did have a daughter. There she is. "My father had a daughter, loved a man. As it might be perhaps were I a woman, I should your lordship." It's a declaration of love, but he's so himself. You know, he doesn't know who she is. But notice how modestly, quiet. She just told the man she loves him. Whoosh, right over his head. Whoosh. And what's her history? Oh, look at this. "A blank, my lord." She has no history. There was no life. There's nothing to tell. "A blank, my lord. She never told her love. But let concealment, like a worm in the bud, feed on her damask cheek. She pined in thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief. Was not this love indeed?" We men may say more, swear more, but indeed our shows are more than will, for still we prove much in our vows, but little in our love. Boy, patience on a monument, smiling at grief. Yellow was obviously the color of death and dying. Okay. Even now, you know, you look yellow, you get jaundiced. It's the vision is of just silently dying away, the way Echo did. The way Echo did. It's a beautiful, beautiful moment. Now, There is life here, okay? Olivia has fallen in love with her, which means Olivia's broken out of the self. She's broken out of her grief. Obviously, it's not possible. But there's a twin brother. And we discover now Sebastian as well has made it to shore. He survived. And now we have the two twins going about the city. Shakespeare had used this before in the Comedy of Errors. It's a great comic possibility for the stage. But here it's got additional depth for a couple of reasons. We've got to bring health back into this society. These are the twins who have survived drowning. Okay? And when we meet Sebastian, Captain Antonio is with him. They're friends. He's concerned about Antonio. Doesn't want Antonio to get into trouble. Of course, he does. And again, all through the play, if you love and loving and serving and sacrificing can mean trouble for you. But there's something else here. I wasn't going to bring it up, but I'm going to. The drowned twins and the play ending and the great moment. Not just that the lovers are united the way they should be, but that the twins come together again. They have both survived. They are both alive. Shakespeare had a first daughter named Susanna. And then he and his wife had twins, a boy and a girl. Boy was named Hamnet, H-A-M-N-E-T. The daughter was named Judith. In 1595, his son died. Nobody knows exactly how the boy died, but there are some rumors, we don't know if they're true or not, legend handed down, that he died by drowning. From that point on, drowning becomes ever more important in Shakespeare. It's in Twelfth Night. Ophelia drowns in Hamlet. The romances are filled with the sea overwhelming ships and people drowning. But what we have here is the lost twins surviving and being reunited. It's got to be something of a dream vision, I think. It almost has to have been the case. This is written some years after the death of the son. There had to be a measure of guilt, simply because Shakespeare, the boy was at home at Stratford. Shakespeare was in London. He was a distant father. And the later plays are filled with the sense of responsibility of the fathers and what happens when the father is not taking care of the family. Had to have been some feeling. The play is moving forward. Sebastian is there. We know he's alive. We get the confusion of identities. I'm not going through any of that. It's great stage business. And we're moving towards the point where there will be the reunion. The brother and sister will find each other again. Before we get there, I want to do one other brief thing. And that is talk about Malvolio and the letter. It's a trick. It's written by Mariah. She can fake the handwriting of Olivia. And she puts it out there in order to trick Malvolio and make him think Olivia's in love with him. And that she wants him to wear yellow stockings, cross-gartered, and walk around with a stupid grin on his face. She gets away with it because, one, Malvolio can't see clearly. It's not Olivia's handwriting. And he should know it. He's her steward. Meaning he's seeing what he wants to see. Number two, she couldn't love him. But he's pretending that she can. And number three, he makes himself read into the letter what he wants to see there and turn it to his own good. What he wants, what you will. What he wills is what he sees in the letter. I taught this play for ages and got an email from a young Catholic fellow, name of Kevin Aschenbach, who had written a paper on Twelfth Night, asked me if I'd look it over. It was a revelation. He made the point, which is brilliant and obvious, and it had never occurred to me before, that what Shakespeare is parodying, because Malvolio is the Puritan, is that we have the Protestant taking the text and making up what he wants to find there to his own good, not what's actually there. And the clearest example of this is just wonderful. M-O-A-I. He sees written there. M, Malvolio, M, why, that begins my name. M, but there is no consonancy in the sequel. That suffers under probation. A should follow, but O does. M-O-A-I. This simulation is not as the former, and yet to crush this a little, it would bow to me, for every one of these letters are in my name. Ooh. Of course. She's talking about me, because the four letters are in my name, therefore it proves she loves me. Wow! It is taking what is there and either refusing to see what is there, misinterpreting what is there, believing in the letter, and missing the larger vision completely. And Malvolio's the Puritan. It's a wonderful little joke. And please notice all the way through the play how letters are going back and forth. Sir Toby doesn't send the letter of challenge to Viola from Sir Andrew because he knows Viola will read it and realize Sir Andrew is an idiot and not be afraid to duel him. And what Sir Toby wants to do is have the two of them scared to death of meeting each other, each one thinking the other is a master fencer. And he knows Viola is smart enough to read the letter, see what's there, and extrapolate correctly on what's actually in the letter, which is what Malvolio cannot do. He creates out of the text what he wants in it. There's a wonderful scene right at the end. If you remember, in the dark house, when Festi comes to him, he says, keeps saying, bring me pen and ink. I must write to my mistress. And finally, Festi agrees, brings him pen and ink, and then Festi brings the letter to Olivia. He says, this is a letter from Malvolio. She says, read it. He starts reading it like a crazy man. Well, she says, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm reading a letter. Well, why like that? Because he's crazy. And a letter from a crazy man should be read like a crazy man. She grabs it away from him, gives it to somebody else to read. Proper reading, proper seeing, proper understanding, the truthfulness of what's there. The play's filled with it. I'm going to the very end of the play, Act 5. By the way, I got to say one thing about Sebastian. I love this. He comes into Illyria. He's wandering around, he's seeing the sights, you know, he's trying to find his friend at the inn, and he's not there, he doesn't know what happened to him. He's walking down the street, and this beautiful woman comes and says, come into the house with me now. And he says, okay. And the next thing that happens, I love it. He comes out of the house, he says, this is the heir, that is the glorious son, this pearl she gave me, I do feel it and see it. This is real. Not dreaming this. This is happening. And then she comes out with the priest and says, come and marry me now. A beautiful woman who's a lady with a big estate and seems lovely and virtuous brings the priest and says, marry me. And Sebastian says, okay. It's a wonderful comic moment. It's just one. But the beautiful thing is, it wouldn't have been possible without the sacrifice made by his sister. Okay? It's the goodness of his sister that makes it possible. It's very funny. It's magical. It's filled with wonder. How can this happen? It happens because his sister is wonderful and prepared the way for it. We come to Act 5, and the Duke finally comes to Olivia's house. This is a big step. This is no small thing. He actually shows, he doesn't send messengers, he actually shows up, makes one last plea, And Olivia has said, no, I not only reject you, I'm in love with him, Viola. The Duke is furious. Why should I not, had I the heart to do it, like to the Egyptian thief at point of death, kill what I love? Love and death. This is anger now. This is rage. And that I partly know the instrument that screws me from my true place in your favor, live you the marble-breasted tyrant still. But this your minion, that's Viola, whom I know you love, and whom by heaven I swear I tender dearly, him will I tear out of that cruel eye where he sits crowned in his master's spite. Come, boy, with me. My thoughts are ripe in mischief. I'll sacrifice the lamb that I do love to spite a raven's heart within a dove. You love him, this one, I'm going to kill him just to spite you, even though I love him too. The innocent lamb. And what we have, of course, again, Shakespeare saw the plays at Coventry. It's one of the greatest of the medieval mystery plays. It's called Abraham and Isaac. I will take what I love and sacrifice it. Now, it's not at God's request. He's doing it out of his own anger. But notice the response. Viola says, and I, most jocund, apt, and willingly, to do you rest, 1,000 deaths would die. Okay. I'm the sacrificial lamb. Then I will die for you. At which point the play works out. She is willing to make the ultimate sacrifice and actually die for love. Loving the other to the point of sacrificing your own life. I will do it. At which point, all of a sudden, Sebastian's there. And he's married to Olivia. And we realize, because the priest says, yes, I just married her. Sir Andrew comes in. He's been beaten up by, he thinks, Viola, who was cowardly before, suddenly is. And Sir Toby's head has had his head broken by the boy. It's Sebastian. It's a manly man. And Sir Toby comes in, tells off Sir Andrew. It's sad. You help me, an asshead and a coxcomb and a knave, a thin-faced knave, a gull. And Andrew's told who he is. And Sir Toby sobers up. And to stay sober, what does he do? He marries Mariah. He begins to take something seriously for a change. And Sebastian enters to apologize to Olivia for beating up her uncle. I'm sorry, madam, I have hurt your kinsman, but had it been the brother of my blood, I must have done no less with wit and safety. And the Duke is looking back and forth. There are the two of them. One face, one voice, one habit, and two persons. A natural perspective that is and is not. These two people can't be in the same place at the same time and be two different people when they're one. Sebastian turns and sees his sister. Do I stand there? I never had a brother. Nor can there be that deity in nature of here and everywhere. I can't be standing here and there. I had a sister whom the blind waves and surges have devoured. Notice the appetite image. Surges have devoured of charity. What kin are you to me? What countryman? What name? What parentage? Of Messaline? Sebastian was my father. Such a Sebastian was my brother too. So went he suited to his watery tomb. If spirits can assume both form and suit, you come to fright us. Sebastian says, a spirit I am indeed, but am in that dimension grossly clad which from the womb I did participate. Yes, I'm a spirit, I'm a soul, I'm a living soul, but I'm wearing the flesh that came when my mother gave birth to me. Were you a woman, as the rest goes even, I should my tears let fall upon your cheek and say, thrice welcome, drowned in my hole. The dead are restored to life again. Why? Sacrifice, selfless love. A willingness to die for others. And what does one get in return? The return of the dead, those we loved and lost. It's everywhere in this man. And then in disbelief, my father had a mole upon his brow, so had mine. I died that day when Viola from her birth had number 30. Okay. We need the identifying marks. The risen dead may stand before you, but I'm not sure I can believe it unless I do what? Can confirm it. Got to confirm it. This can't be real. This can't have happened, but sure enough. Sure enough. We have a happy ending, but Malvolio storms in. Accuses. How could you do this to me? Shows Olivia the letter and says, this isn't my writing. And then the truth comes out. It was a plot. It was done to humble him. And his response is not to learn, not to become humble and to forgive, but to become enraged. Festi repeats, some are born great, some achieve great, some, and he and then says, and thus the whirligig of time brings in his revenges. And Malvolio storms out saying, I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you. And storms out. Olivia says, he hath been most notoriously abused. The Duke says, pursue him and entreat him to a peace, and we want him part of the community. Now, Olivia and the Duke are now concerned about someone else outside themselves. But they've made good love matches, and society is blooming again. There's a chance for a future here. They care about someone else, the other, who's been hurt and wronged, and we go off to celebrate the three marriages, the Duke and Viola, Olivia and Sebastian, Sir Toby Belch and Mariah, and the fool is left alone on stage and sings a little song. For a long time, people say, oh, it's an interpolation. Shakespeare didn't write it. Of course he did. The clown sings it. I want to go through it. I'm at the very end of the play. When that I was in a little tiny boy with hey, ho, the wind and the rain, a foolish thing was but a toy, for the rain it raineth every day. But when I came to man's estate with hey, ho, the wind and the rain, against knaves and thieves men shut their gate, for the rain it raineth every day. But when I came, alas, to wive, with hey, ho, the wind and the rain, by swaggering could I never thrive, for the rain, it raineth every day. But when I came unto my beds, with hey, ho, the wind and the rain, with tosspots still had drunken heads, for the rain, it raineth every day. A long while ago the world begun. With hey, ho, the wind and the rain, but that's all one. Our play is done, and we'll strive to please you every day. How odd a comedy should end with the invocation of wind and rain. We have the happy ending, but there's a recognition here that it's not all smooth sailing all the time. And indeed, we get a very curious process of living a life. When I was a little tiny boy, a foolish thing was but a toy. When I was really young, when I was a child, I just delighted in things, and things were fun, and I played with toys. But when I came to man's estate, what did I discover? There's evil in the world. Against knaves and thieves, men shut their gate. You better protect yourself. This is a sense of the house as a place of protection. because you know what's out there, and it's a very real. You got to be careful. I could no longer just foolishly, innocently play with toys. But when I came, alas, to wife, there's a little joke. And then I got married. By swaggering, could I never thrive? And I thought, I'm married now. I can go out in the world. I can make my way in the world. I can be a swaggerer. I can present myself. I can be famous and make money and do it. I could never thrive. I never really did what I thought I could do. When I came into my beds, old, weak, and tired, with tosspots still had drunken heads, spent my time with my friends, tossing back a few and talking about the old days, what it was like. It's not cynical like Jaques. It's sorrowful about the real condition of the world. An odd end to a comedy. A great while ago, the world begun with hey-ho, the wind and the rain. It's been windy and raining for a long time. But that's all one. Nothing we can do about it. Our play is done. This is the end of it now. And we'll strive to please you every day. Hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you come back tomorrow, because we'll try to do something else to please you. But there is a pun there. I am convinced of it. This was Shakespeare's last golden comedy. Our play is done. I can't play around anymore. This was beautiful. This was nice. But the wind is coming and the rain is coming and sorrow is coming. And I've got a whole new area of things I've got to explore and study. And the next play he wrote, probably in the same year, was called Hamlet. And suddenly Malvolio's I'll Be Revenged on the Whole Pack of You. Revenge? Little play called Hamlet. All about revenge. Not a comedy in which those who drown don't come back to life, in which those who die come back and tell you to kill your uncle. That's all one. Our play is done, and we'll strive to please you every day. We hope you will still like what's coming. It'll be a play. We hope it pleases you. I think it's a little warning saying, the joyful mysteries are done. I'm moving on to the sorrowful ones. With revenge, with lies, the broken marriage of Othello and Desdemona, and the wind and the rain in storm on the heath. With the fool by Lear's side singing, he that has and a little tiny wit, with hey-ho, the wind and the rain, must make content with his fortune's fit, for the rain, it raineth every day. Our play is done. I'll strive to please you every day. Thank you very much.
What do you say about the child being dead and... Well, there was the twins from back to life, but then it's just something about, like, the parent lamenting.
It's, I we don't know for, because he wasn't at home. If you're earning your living in a different city, a long way from where your family is, and your child dies, there's got to be guilt. There has to be guilt. Now, this is how he made his living. This is how he supported them. He had the good sense not to bring his family to London. They're better off in small town Stratford, which is, you know, and they were with his parents. And he went there whenever he could visit. But while he's gone, his son died. The Shakespeare name wasn't carried on. His two daughters lived. But his son, for a man to have his son die when he's working in another town, has to have had an effect. I can't verify that. But it sure makes sense to me. I don't know. Yeah. Fire away. That I don't know. It's a sea town in Greece, as I understand it, or somewhere in Turkey. And that I don't know. There could well be a reason. If you dig deep enough in Shakespeare, there's always a reason. I've never come up with one. Unlike Arden, where it's very clear, I have no idea why I called it Valerian. But somebody will come up with it someday, I'm sure. Yeah. He never did anything accidentally. Never. He was a smart cookie.
How do we read Shakespeare better?
Aloud.
Aloud?
Get together in a group and read it aloud together. Everybody take a part and read it aloud to each other. And when you finish a scene, talk about it. And again, part of it is you can't read poetry on the page. If it's just the eye engaging, you've got to hear it. You've got to hear it. If you're reading it aloud, one, it slows you down. And two, even if you're not a good reader, you can hear the sounds. You can hear some of the music. And the music is just gorgeous. It's verbal music. It's gorgeous stuff. The best way is to memorize it. You take it in, it becomes part of you, and you have it forever. And the longer you... Let me put it this way. Now, it's not equivalent, but it's like learning the beautiful prayers. And once you've learned them, the more you say them, they become part of you, and you really grasp the beauty of them. In the natural sphere, on the level of art, if you learn poetry, the same thing happens. It becomes a part of you. You can keep uncovering the riches in it. It's like hearing a beautiful piece of music. The more time you hear it, the more you can respond to it, because the music becomes part of you. And you absorb it. It's true. Poetry is verbal music, so the same thing can happen. Yeah. Yeah. Read it aloud together. Yeah. With all the free time you have.
One of my questions was about Shakespeare's music. Did he write music to
No, he didn't. All the songs, there are a lot of songs in 12th. I mean, all the comedies have songs in them. We don't know who composed the songs, who did the music. They probably had a company musician. We have some of the songs, but some of the music, but not all of them. Some of it was written down, some of it we have, much of it's lost. There's a book that came out about 6-7 years ago called Shakespeare's Songbook, where the guy puts together the music that we do have, and then there's a CD that comes with it. So you can actually hear the original songs. What happens now, and I think it's fair, is in any production, they'll hire a composer to write new music for the songs, which is fine. It gives employment to musicians. The guy who did the music for Much Ado About Nothing did his own setting of those songs. I think they're beautiful. I think they're lovely. He did a nice job. And he got a paycheck, so it's a good thing. So it's many famous composers have set the songs in Shakespeare's voice. Even some who there is a setting by Joseph Haydn of She Never Told Her Love. It's that passage of poetry. For some reason, Haydn set it to music. And it's a little song. Just that, who knows? Who knows? It's wonderful. There's a wonderful setting by Franz Schubert of a song from Two Gentlemen of Verona to Sylvia. Who is Sylvia? What is she that all our swains commend her? Holy, fair, and wise is she. A heaven such grace did lend her that admired she might be. Is she kind as she is fair? For beauty lives with kindness. Love doth... I've lost it. To her eyes... love doth to her eyes repair to cure him of his blindness, and being loved inhabits there. Then to Sylvia let us sing, this Sylvia is excelling. She excels all mortal things upon this poor earth dwelling. To her garlands let us bring, to her garlands let us bring. Schubert said it. It's a gorgeous song. All sorts of composers set these things. They're wonderful. Oh, yeah, it's good. It's good stuff. Yes.
What do you think of the productions in Stratford, Ontario?
I love them. I saw a number of them. You will see the As You Like It from 1981. Okay, it's magnificent. Unfortunate. The thing you could always count on at Stratford was it would be done straight. They wouldn't mess with it until the new director took over just last year and is now goofing. He did a Macbeth set in Africa where Lady Macbeth was Michelle Obama. Grenades going off and jeeps and AK-47s and just, I was up there, I didn't bother to go see it. Then he brought in a director who did a Midsummer Night's Dream that was punk and leather. Rock and roll, punk and leather. I didn't go see that either. But when I was up there, I was talking to the woman who owned the motel where I stayed. And she said, have you seen the Midsummer Night's Dream? I said, no, I'm not going to see it. She said, well, that's, she said, I didn't like it. She said, my 12-year-old daughter had read the play and studied the play and was so excited and went to see it. And we're driving home and she hadn't said anything. So I said to her, well, did you like the play? She said, I wanted fairies. It's a little girl. She wanted pretty costumes. Absolutely. Then she got whang, 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 you know, and leather and punk and tattoos and oh, yeah. I mean, I can go visit my friends and see that, right? I go to the theater. I want to see pretty things. The commitment to ugliness is everywhere. In fact, I just heard the same director is doing As You Like It this year. He's taking as his concept. It's a painting by Magritte, a 20th century artist, of this open window in the midst of which is a gigantic apple. Boy, I'm going to rush off and buy tickets. And people aren't going to these. The ticket sales are falling. And they're saying, gee, I wonder what people aren't going to the theater anymore. No, they're not, because they've got taste. However, having said that, they did Ben Jonson's Bartholomew Fair. It was great. They did Racine's Phaedra, magnificent production, and the best Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde I ever could dream of seeing. It was so good to bring it to Broadway. So there's still good work being done. Unfortunately, they're mucking around with the Shakespeare. It's a shame. But As You Like It, you're going to see is really good. Really good. I have happy memories of Stratford. And I'll go back again. But what you have to do is read ahead of time and see what they've got there. And all you have to do, you read a paragraph about what the production is like, you know whether you want to see it. If they mucked with it, avoid it. It's that simple. Yeah.
Some speculation that Shakespeare
also... No, the fool here would have been Robert Armin. It would have been Robert Armin. He did, because he clearly was a good singer. I don't know that Shakespeare wasn't, but there are none of the roles he performed that we know he performed or he ever sang. No, he did, as I said, he did Adam in As You Like It, he did The Ghost in Hamlet. He did secondary roles, supporting roles, usually for a couple of scenes or just briefly. So it's interesting, he only starred in one play. And it was a play by his friendly rival Ben Jonson, Every Man in His Humor. It's the only time Shakespeare played a lead. And I don't know, either he wasn't real good, or he didn't enjoy it and didn't want it from that point on, he just played supporting parts. They were, you know, it's wonderful the way that Jonson and Shakespeare were just like this. They were the two big playwrights, and obviously good friends. But Jonson was constantly criticizing Shakespeare. He wrote too much, and the plays were sprawling. He didn't follow the classical unities. And, you know, the guy who wrote, who made the comment about seeing Shakespeare write, he never blotted out a line. Jonson's response was, "Would he have blotted 1,000?" He just wrote too. He wouldn't rewrite. He wouldn't make the plays perfect. He just kept writing. There's a wonderful story. We actually have one story. Somebody, after a performance, saw Shakespeare and Jonson go to the tavern. After every performance, theater people go to the tavern. That's just a given. Okay. So, but they only performed in the afternoon. So it was late afternoon, production done, performance done, and Jonson and Shakespeare are in the tavern, and they're having a few, and they get into a quarrel. We don't know what they were arguing about, but obviously they argued a lot. Very different opinions, both brilliant men. And the guy who describes it said, Jonson presented his arguments like a great stately galleon plowing his way through the waters. And Shakespeare was a little skiff, just darting around the surface of the water, hitting Johnson from every side, where Johnson didn't know he was going to be hit next. I love that description. The legend is, this is legend, we can't prove it. When Shakespeare died, it's because he had left London. He lived in Stratford for 4 years. He built the biggest house in Stratford. He bought property. He was a landowner and highly respected, the most famous citizen in the town. He had his family. It was a good retirement. It's nothing like a good retirement. He was very comfortable. He was doing well. Well, legend has it that Ben Jonson and Michael Drayton came down to visit him for his birthday. And they did what old friends do when they get together. They were partying. And then Shakespeare caught a chill and became ill and died. In a way, I hope it's true. I mean, not a bad way to go. And we know he got last rites. So, but of course, he died tomorrow. No, Friday is his birthday and his death day. He was born and died on the same day, April 23rd, the feast of Saint George, the patron saint of England. What is it? Again, God's. I call it God's thumbprint. Anybody who wants to look, here it is. Yeah. Interesting, I mentioned this last year, Cervantes died on the same day. Cervantes died on the same day. But it was when the folio was printed in 1623, 7 years after Shakespeare's death, and thank goodness they did, or we wouldn't have half the plays. We wouldn't have As You Like It. We wouldn't have Much Ado. They first appear in the folio, the complete works of 1623. But Jonson wrote two memorial poems, a short one that's wonderful, and then a long elegy to the memory of my beloved William Shakespeare and what he hath left us. And it's in there, first time ever. It must have killed Jonson. He's a very proud man. But he goes through and he admits he was the greatest comic writer of the age. He was up there with Terence and Plautus. He was the greatest tragic writer of the age, but as great as the Greek tragedians. And then he says, but he was not of an age, but for all time. Jonson was the first one who knew this guy, these will last forever. Had to have killed him because he had a giant ego, but he admits it there. Yeah, he admits it. Yeah.
Shakespeare's body never exhumed just because of the curse on his tomb.
Yeah. Well, and also, and it's fair, but the local authorities won't allow it. Yeah. You're not going to go digging up the grave. No, certainly not. So it never has been. All sorts of speculations that there may be lost plays hidden in there. And there are only two lost plays that we know of. A lost early comedy called Love's Labor's One. It shows up on a list of his plays. Nobody knows what it is. There's no other reference to it. Some think he rewrote it later as the dark comedy All's Well That Ends Well that doesn't end well at all. A really dark play. But we don't know what it is. And then the other was the collaboration with John Fletcher called Cardenio, based on a short story that's included in Quixote. It's part of Quixote. But there was apparently a manuscript of Cardenio along with some other Shakespeare manuscripts. I think I did mention this last year. It was owned by a Dr. Warburton. And Dr. Warburton was not at home one day, and his cook was baking pies and needed paper to line the pie plates. Couldn't find any, went into Warburton's study. She was illiterate. Found some old paper. Well, who's going to want these? Lined the pie plates with them. Put the pies in the oven, and there went the only existing Shakespeare manuscripts. What can you say? But they must have been very good pies. Very tasty pies. Yeah. Literate pies. Yes. But he's the best. Well, Dante and Shakespeare. It's the great Eliot line. Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them. There is no third. That's a wonderful line.
Hey, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Any speculation whether
you'll
come back next year?
It depends on if I'm alive and what's going on in the world, but I'm always happy to come back. And
what would you speak on if you
were? I don't know. I don't know. I haven't given it any thought. What I most enjoy speaking on is Shakespeare. That's what I spent my life doing. So, and now that I don't do it on a regular basis, I realize I've never given a public lecture on Romeo and Juliet. So I should do that sometime. And I've never lectured on the Roman plays, Julius Caesar, Antony and Cleopatra, and Coriolanus. There are a lot of other things. A lot of other things. I did a series on the history plays at the SSPX house in London. Richard II, both parts of Henry IV and Henry V. I think they have those on CD over there, and they're selling them. So, but that was a great honor and very scary to go to England and lecture to the English about their great writer on English history. Ooh. Talk about a bold move. But they were wonderful. No, they were very, very good, very kind. It was a great, great visit. Great visit. Yes?
Can I ask a question about the Duke?
Certainly.
Because at the beginning when she, Viola, asks about him, he says he's a man noble in name and nature. And then when she speaks with Olivia, she says, I know him to be noble, virtuous, etc. Is he just overwhelmed with his passion? It doesn't seem he's a bad man.
He is not a bad man. No one says a word against him. He is a man who has a huge flaw, okay? And the flaw is he's consumed with his passion. But the other flaw is the passion doesn't really go outward. He just loves the passion for its own sake. But you see it again. He clearly is a passionate man. When he threatens to kill Viola, that's excessive. That's just, you know, again, it's excess. It's excess. And we're not sure he would actually do it. It's probably just a threat. But the threat is taken away when she says, okay, go ahead. I mean, but that very offer, and suddenly everything works out. No, he is apparently a very noble, very good, virtuous man. Very good, very noble, virtuous men can have huge flaws. And again, what's interesting, Shakespeare goes from this directly into the great tragedies, which is all about great men who have flaws. Yeah.
When we deal with tragedy and comedy, is right now, I mean, present day, is comedy more helpful than tragedy? As far as with people that we work?
No one can write tragedy any longer for a number of reasons. Number one, tragedy depends on an intense belief in the supernatural, in something greater than man. And we are trapped in the mundane. We cannot believe there's anything more than nature. We can't believe anything's higher than science. That's the first reason. Number two, tragedy depends totally on hierarchy. You can't have tragedy without hierarchy for this reason. As Aristotle says in his Poetics, when he's defining tragedy, tragedy has to be of a certain magnitude. And what that means is it can't just be the story of one guy who falls and we feel. The example I always give is Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, where he tried to write the tragedy of the common man. It's a good play. It works well on stage. We feel sympathy for Willie Loman. But it has no magnitude. It's a domestic drama that's sad. It's not tragedy. Magnitude means not only does the hero have a flaw and fall, but he brings a whole world down with him. Hence, when Aristotle talks about pity and fear, one reason we fear when we watch a tragedy is that fellow's mistake could destroy me, and I won't know anything about it. Okay? End of Hamlet, the whole court of Denmark is dead. Your average Dane out making cheese suddenly is his country's taken over by Norwegians. You know, what happened here? Scotland, all of a sudden, Scotland's a bloodbath. It's horror. How did this let me say, there's only one American tragedy. Because tragedy is totally incompatible with the idea of democracy. You can't do it. It's impossible. So that when our greatest writer decided he wanted to write a tragedy, he studied King Lear and Macbeth especially, and then went to the only place in America there was a hierarchy, and that's a sailing ship. And he wrote a book called Moby Dick, in which you have a mad captain and all of these ranks below him down to the common seamen. And at the end, it's tragic. Ahab's fall brings down the whole ship. The Pequod sinks at the end. You know, only Ishmael's left to tell the story. That, it's a real tragedy. It's in a novel, but it's a real tragedy. And boy, it has magnitude and power and size and scope. And in creating Ahab, Melville created the greatest of all American characters. It's the one book in American literature that ranks with the great books of all of world literature. Yeah. It's magnificent. And it's also the history of the country in miniature, which scares the life out of me. Yeah.
This is, I guess, more pastoral, but if tragedy is not, well, we can't write a great tragedy, not Paul's Fest, but if it's
right.
Paul's and Paul's Horse write a great tragedy, the people that we'll be working with, and obviously they need to learn literature, etc., but with technologies that are, entertainment becomes video games. And
absolutely. Music.
So eventually, probably the only exposure people will have to literature, et cetera, is via conference, listening to someone audio read. But if that's the case, would one focus more on a comedy? Would one focus more on the glorious mysteries where you have the tragedy and redemption?
Let me put it this way. Just as we do with the rosary, on different days we pray different mysteries, okay? So that one can move from one to another. And let me say this. This may sound crazy, but I don't think it is. We have computers, we have video games, we've got the TVs, we've got all of this until the power goes out. And at any moment, God can take away the power, at which point people are going to pick this up, and the only entertainment they can have is, let's do a scene from Midsummer Night's Dream, because we can't turn... This won't turn on. There's nothing here. What are we going to do? I don't know. Is there a book around? What's a book? I got my Kindle. Yeah, but there's nothing on it. What am I going to do? Well, I think Johnny had a book upstairs. He was in school once. What is it? Some Shakespeare thing. Well, boy, this is weird. Let's try it. I swear that's what's going to happen. In the same way, I mean, the pride of men. Airplanes zooming all around the world. I'm getting on a plane in Chicago, and I'm flying to Johannesburg, and I'm getting on a plane in Prague, and I'm flying to Perth, and I'm growing roses in Kenya and sending them to San Francisco, and I'm growing tomatoes in Argentina, and I'm sending them to New York City, and whoosh, all of a sudden it stops because... God said, let her blow. And all of a sudden it's like, what happened? What happened? What happened is, you're not in control the way you think you are. Wait till the power goes out. If you don't know this essay, read it. But I think the single greatest essay written in my lifetime by a very brilliant woman named Solange Hertz. I just took her out to celebrate her 90th birthday. She's still alive, okay? It's called Hell's Amazing Grace. It's an essay about electricity. Man, is it good. It explains the whole game. And it also explains why at some point God will just pull the plug. And mankind will go, what do you mean I can't use my Mixmaster? You know, how do I make pancakes? How do I mash the potatoes? What do I do? Well, they used to have this thing called a potato masher, and you took it and you went, boom, boom. Well, that's work. I stand there and just go like this with the potatoes. I can't cook them. There's no, you have to build a fire, put them in the, cook potatoes in the fireplace. What do you think? It's going to be unbelievable. But God, at any moment he wants, can just pull the plug and the whole thing shuts down. I think the volcano's but the beginning. But the Beginning.
What was her name that wrote Hell's Beginning?
Solange Hertz, H-E-R-T-Z. It's in a book of essays called Beyond Politics.
Beyond Politics.
And, oh man, is it good. Every essay in there is brilliant. She is a brilliant writer. She's dismissed by many people because she doesn't footnote. But I was surrounded by people who footnoted every idiocy they put down on paper. I'm not impressed by footnotes. I'm impressed by wisdom that knows something and tells me something that's profound, and you can tell it's real and believable. This lady knows stuff. Great lady. Great lady. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Devout. Devout. I think she may be one of the handful of great Catholic writers of the age. Nobody reads her. Nobody knows her.
Yeah, I've never heard of her.
No. Oh, she's just... She wrote for The Remnant for years. Well, she had books published before Vatican II. When Vatican II came along, she lost her publishers. They wouldn't print her anymore. So she wrote... She raised five kids. Her husband was the first civilian captured by the Viet Cong in Vietnam. For about 20 years, she had no idea what happened to him. And then learned that they'd killed him the first week. So she raised the five children by herself. All four of the five apostatized, went Novus Ordo. The one who lived died in a car wreck, killed by a drunken driver, the one she was closest to. Sad. But she kept writing, went on about her business. Yes.
You have promises to keep and miles to go before you sleep.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. But it's been wonderful being here, gentlemen.
Thank you so much,
Doctor. Thanks a lot.
God willing, and if the crick don't rise, I'll come back again someday.
Read the Sorrowful Mysteries next year.
I'm always willing to talk about tragedy. It's all around us, and soon there will be more. So, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pray for me. I'll pray for all of you.